Each of us comes this morning with a variety of things on our mind, putting us in the past, present, and future all at once. In my own case, I find myself preparing for next week's meeting with representatives from all three tikangas of the Anglican province of Aotearoa, New Zealand, and Polynesia. It's a deceptively obscure but alliterative title. It's called the Hermeneutics Hui. A hui, as most Kiwis know, is just a meeting. Hermeneutics is a little more complicated. It's an art form taught to budding theologians, usually in seminary. It's why I went to seminary, to find out what hermeneutics meant. While it is more than this, simply put, it is a process that is the foundation of every sermon. It seeks to tease out of Scripture what it meant at the time and apply it in a way that makes it useful today. The root of the word is the Greek messenger god Hermes. Hermeneutics is about bringing the message forward, dusting off the past, so that it can be heard appropriately today, so it might be lived out tomorrow. In the case of this hui, the intent is to discuss what Scripture has to say about human sexuality. In particular, we will be looking at the few instances where Scripture is purported to have something to say about homosexuality. I don't think the hope is that the diverse elements in the church will find agreement in what they mean to us today. That is probably impossible. Only slightly more possible is that mutual respect might be the fruit of these meetings. My personal hope is that it might be the first step in dismantling the sacred. This hui, Margaret Bedgegood and I will be attending as two of the representatives from the Diocese of Auckland, has gathered twice before since 2007, and will meet once more before it is concluded. It is an experiment that seeks unity in the face of the well-publicized schism in the Anglican Communion. Too bad it doesn't also seek truth. Some believe the fracture is the fault of the Americans and Canadians. The Americans, as we all know, ordained an openly gay man and recently a lesbian as bishops. The Canadians approve publicly blessing same-sex unions. Others believe that this was just the proverbial straw that broke the communion's back. The forces of division have been in play ever since new prayer books came out in the 70s and 80s that began a process that St. Matthew's continues today, of favoring scholarship over tradition and modern and inclusive language over the more poetic but less comprehensible Elizabethan tongue. It was further exacerbated by ordaining women to the priesthood, and later as bishops, and lastly as a primate in the U.S. Most of the Anglican Church does not see these women as legitimately ordained on the grounds that it violates the male-imposed traditions of the church. It is not surprising that those most resistant to our renewal of worship and the inclusion of women in ordained ministry are most angered by the idea of openly including gays and lesbians as full participants in the church. It is my view that the Anglican Communion is not divided by the recent acts of the North American churches, but by two very different views of what the church has been is, and is becoming. As a result, the Archbishop of Canterbury has been scrambling to find a way to make the schism go away. What he and a majority of his fellow primates have settled on is a new Anglican covenant, most of its boilerplate. We Americans would describe it as flag, mom, and apple pie. They are long-held agreements of what holds Anglicans together that few would dispute. But the critical piece gives the primates unprecedented power to punish, up to and including expulsion, provinces like those in Canada and the U.S. that act in a way not approved of by the majority of other provinces. By far, most of the churches in the communion are the fruit of the 18th and 19th century English evangelical missionaries that were sent to the colonies. These churches have a traditional view of what it means to be church. Under the covenant, they will hold immense power over those seeking new ways of being the church. Progressive churches and provinces will either have to stop seeking justice for those the church has marginalized and forsake new knowledge and understanding of what it means to be faithful in the 21st century, or continue to do so, waiting to be kicked out. Should this covenant be approved, the church will become less divided, but smaller by necessity. But in whatever unity it gains, it will lose the creative tension that has always existed between what we want to hold on to and what we need to let go of. For now, that tension still exists. From my perspective, that still gives the church a glimmer of hope to continue its supporting role in our walk of faith. As coincidence or grace would have it, as I prepare for this meeting, our readings give a roadmap, not just for the church, but for each of us in our daily lives. In both cases, dismantling is involved. Our first reading is a story about letting go. Elijah, the foremost prophet of the Hebrew Scriptures, passes his mantle to his successor, Elisha. After granting Elisha's wish for a double portion of his power, he makes a grand exit in a whirlwind on a fiery chariot. Looks like a good day for Elisha. He's probably ecstatic at his newfound position and power. Elijah made headlines when he defeated the priests of the Canaanite god Baal on Mount Carmel. It too was great theater. Elijah challenged them to a duel of sorts between their god Baal and his Yahweh. Whose god could burn a sacrifice on an altar without using a match? Baal got to go first, but the sacrifice remained unroasted. Elijah mocked their god, suggesting he had to rush off to the long drop. Then Elijah, to rub it in, drenched his sacrifice in water three times and then called on Yahweh to show his stuff. Pillar of fire came down and made an ash of the sacrifice. Elijah then did a high five by calling on the spectators to slaughter the 450 priests of Baal. While Elisha is aware of this mountaintop experience, which he thinks he can now do twice as well, he is not aware of a second one his mentor had that led to his getting the mantle. Apparently, bloodlust for God was not as satisfying as Elijah thought it would be. It puts him into a slump. Elijah cries out for death as he is no better than his fathers. God tells him, go to a different mountain and wait for him. It is on this mountain that Elijah encounters God, not in the theatrics of an earthquake or storm, but in stillness. The still small voice dismantles his understanding of the sacred. God is not about power. God is not about competition and besting rivals. God is not about sacred violence. In the darkness of the cave, Elijah blushes that he thought God was his to use for his purposes instead of the other way around. I think it is probably at that moment he decided to let go of his position as chief prophet and dismantle himself. In the gospel reading, we have Jesus making plain Elijah's experience. When the disciples want him to incinerate the Samaritans, notorious for worshiping on the wrong mountain, for being inhospitable to Jews who have long treated them as less than human, Jesus tells them, let it go. God isn't a weapon of mass destruction. God isn't about power, but love. God is about giving life, not taking it. After dismantling their view of the sacred, he offers a new understanding. God doesn't reside any place, yet is found everywhere. God is not in the past, but in the moment, facing the future. Follow a loving spirit. It leads to God's kingdom. My hope is that the Hui hears the still small voice of God and, like Elijah, blushes. I hope it leads to our dismantling our traditional notions of the sacred, that it might lead to holiness, truth, and justice. Letting go of our prejudices and certainties of the past is not easy. It can lead to a crisis in confidence, but it frees our heart to become one with the sacred now. It will be a wild ride, not unlike riding a whirlwind in a fiery chariot, but well worth the trip.